Hi, my name is Mike, and I'm one of the ministers here at the church. I'd like to start by thanking you for listening to this sermon online. Before we get started, I'd just like to say that we truly hope that this audio recording will encourage you in your walk with God. But we also hope that it would just be supplemental to your relationship with Jesus, and that it would in no way replace the church that you should be plugged into or the spiritual leaders God has put in your life to shepherd you. So please, enjoy the next 30 minutes or so of this message. I pray it will challenge and uplift you wherever you are in your spiritual journey. God bless. Well, good morning, everyone. Good to be with you this morning. Glad that you are here. If you're a guest with us this morning, we're especially glad to have you here. Hope you'll hang around afterwards and visit with us. And you're welcome to stay for potluck afterwards, too, even if you didn't bring anything. We'd love for you to stay around and get to visit you during that as well. If you're watching online, glad you could tune in that way this morning as well. This is a big celebration week. I don't know if you noticed all that, but I was looking at the calendar and I realized that I think it's Tuesday that is the Lunar New Year. So anyone who follows that calendar, Happy New Year to you. Of course, tomorrow is Family Day, which makes a long weekend for most of us, which is always something worth celebrating. And yesterday was Valentine's Day, so I know some of you may have celebrated Valentine's Day yesterday, or some of you may have been waiting for today to celebrate. All the Valentine stuff is on sale, so you can stock up day. And whatever you're celebrating this weekend, I hope it brings you some joy. This morning we're going to be in Mark chapter 8, so if you have a Bible and want to follow along, you can flip or click over to that. This week my family played a round of Clue at home, but we didn't play the classic board game Clue. This version you actually play on your TV and on your phones. And before we could get started, everyone had to choose a username for their character to play under during the game. And I went through several names before I finally settled on one. Part of that is because I wasn't really paying attention and I kept doing it wrong over and over. And part of it was because I just had a hard time choosing what I wanted my player to be called. I could go with something kind of standard like just Mike, but I was playing with my kids, so that felt a little bit weird for it to be Mike, and so I could go more traditional and just put Dad, but my kids are almost grown up, so that feels a little bit weird, and then I was like, well, what if I put Dad, but my wife doesn't put Mom? That's a little bit awkward. And I thought, well, what if she puts Mom and I don't put Dad? That's going to be awkward, too. Thought I could go with maybe one of my default names, like Socks and Tacos or Comical Moniker, but I thought, well, that's not very original for me. That's kind of what I always do. Then I thought, well, I could go with something funny, a funny name. I thought that would be good. But it's got to be good funny, not bad funny. Unless it's intentionally bad funny, then that's okay. And it's got to be a joke that everyone's going to get or relate to. And I decided that's a lot of pressure to put on someone, to pick a name, because that's going to be your identity for the entire game, and it's going to pop up on the screen every time it's your turn to play. So it took me a while to settle on something. Now that might be a silly example, but who we are is a huge deal for all of us. And in real life, there is the question of who am I carries far more weight and consequence than it does in a simple game of Clue. It's incredibly important how we answer that question for ourselves. But I would argue that it's far more important how we answer that question in regard to Jesus. How you answer the question, who is Jesus, will dramatically impact your entire life, no matter what your answer to that question is. So we want to spend the next few weeks kind of considering how the Bible answers that question and what it tells us about who Jesus is. And we're particularly for those of us who have committed ourselves to following Jesus, this is a big question for us. But I think it's also important for those who are kind of still weighing the merits of making that decision. So we're going to do that over the next few weeks, and we're specifically going to look at the information we're given about Jesus through the Gospel of Mark. Mark is kind of split into two acts. Act 1 is chapters 1 through 8. Acts 2 is chapters 9 through 16. And in Act 1, Mark is trying to paint a picture for his readers of who Jesus is. And so to do that, Mark shows Jesus traveling all around Galilee, doing all sorts of unexpected and unexplainable things. First half of Mark is just chock full of all these stories of Jesus healing people. He heals the frantic and the fevered. He heals the lame and the leprous. He heals the blind and the bleeding. He heals the mute and the maimed, and he heals the deaf and, yes, even the dead. And in addition to all of these healings, Mark always also gives us some other amazing stories, like when Jesus feeds thousands and thousands of people with a small boy's even smaller lunch. Or Jesus goes out walking on the water in the middle of the night in the middle of the sea. Or he calms a violent storm with just a few gentle words. And everywhere he went, crowds gathered around Jesus. He cannot enter a town in secret. People recognized him immediately, and the word spread about him everywhere. Time and time again, Mark records that the people saw what Jesus had done, and they were filled with amazement. They couldn't believe their eyes. They asked themselves, who is this guy? This guy who says and does all these amazing things. But in chapter 8, at the end of Act 1, things begin to take a turn. Up until now, Jesus, according to Mark's itinerary, Jesus had just been kind of traveling around the area of Galilee. If you follow through the Gospel of Mark, here's where you'll see Jesus go. First, he goes to Capernaum, and then to Tyre and Sidon, and then back to Galilee, and then to the Gerasenes, and then he goes across the lake, and then he goes down to Nazareth, and then to Bethsaida, and then to Gennesaret, and then to Tyre, and then down to the Decapolis, and then to Dalmanutha, and then to the other side of the lake, and to Bethsaida, and then he gets lazy and just says, well, he went from town to town to town, and then he went across the lake and back, and then finally ends up in Caesarea Philippi. And at the end of chapter 8, everything changes. Up until now, Jesus' classroom had been in sailboats and synagogues, but from now on, it's going to be on the road. As we go on from chapter 8, we see that in 9, he says, they came to Capernaum, and he asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? In chapter 10, Jesus started on his way, and a man ran up to him. Again, chapter 10, this time verse 32. They were on their way to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. In chapter 10, verse 46, then they came to Jericho, and his disciples together with a large crowd were leaving the city, and a blind man, Bartimaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. Now in verse 52, go, Jesus said. And the man received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. Not only is Jesus on the move, but he's moving with purpose and direction. Up until now, he had just kind of been circling around the Sea of Galilee with his disciples. But from now on, he's going to make a straight line headed south. He starts in Caesarea Philippi, and then he comes down to Capernaum, and then all the way down to Jericho, and then straight over to Jerusalem. But before they can make that turn, before they can change course, before we can move into Act 2, there's one critical piece of business that needs to be taken care of. So in Mark 8:27, we read, Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked them, who do people say I am? Who am I? This is the question that Jesus asks the disciple. It's also the question that Mark has been asking his readers. And this is unmistakably the climax of Act 1. The disciples have been meandering around the masses. They heard what the people were saying. They know what the people are thinking. And so they reply, some say John the Baptist,
others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. See, it's clear that the people recognized that Jesus was some kind of messenger from God. He was some kind of prophet. Even in John 3, we see Nicodemus, who was a Pharisee, who has been called teacher of teachers. He comes and meets with Jesus, and even he says, "We know you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you're doing if God were not with him." There's more to Jesus than just that. He's more than just another prophet or messenger from God. And so Jesus asks his disciples the million-dollar question. But what about you? Who do you say I am? Peter answered, "You are the Christ." And with that bold statement, the curtain closes on Act 1. You know, I think there are two kinds of TV shows out there. There's the one kind that kind of wraps everything up really neatly at the end of each episode, ties up all the loose ends, and kind of just puts it all together, gets everything resolved. So you can start out the next week fresh without having to tie up any loose ends, and you can maybe even not even have seen last week's episode, but still just dive in this week. And then there's the other kind of show that leaves you hanging every week. Steve's about to open the mysterious letter. What does it say? Or Harry just proposed to Sally. Will she say yes? The doctor comes to explain to Carlos about Juanita's surgery. Did it go well? Were there complications? Jenny has a big decision to make, and she's on a clock. She has to decide in 3, 2, 1, roll credits. And you gotta wait till next week to find out how it will all turn out. What will the final resolution be? And I think at first glance, Mark seems to be one of those wrapping everything up types. It seems like everything has kind of come full circle. Mark begins his gospel by saying this, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. And now Peter brings us back to the exact same conclusion. You are the Christ. And through the first 8 chapters, Mark has been prompting his readers to answer this question, who is Jesus? And now we have our answer. Jesus is the Christ. And you would expect at this point, Jesus would say, "Hallelujah! You guys got it! Finally! Took longer than I thought it should, but you got it! Excellent! Okay, now go out and tell everyone what you've just finally figured out, alright? Let's print up some brochures, let's get a website up and running, somebody tweet this while I go change my Facebook status." But that's not exactly how Jesus responds. Instead, he warned them not to tell anyone about him. Well, what's up with that? Hold on to that question for a minute. Flip the page over to Mark chapter 9. About a week after the story we just read, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up to the top of a mountain. Now, going up to the top of a mountain is meant to peak Mark's reader's interest. Now, because big, important God stuff often happens at the top of a mountain. And now Jesus, just recently recognized by his disciples as being the Christ, takes them up to, of all places, the top of a mountain. And if you were a Jew reading this story, your mind would have immediately gone back to one of a couple stories in the Old Testament. Perhaps your mind would have gone back to Exodus chapter 19. The Israelites have escaped Israel, Egypt. They have crossed the Red Sea. They're out in the Sinai desert, and God descends on Mount Sinai. The top of the mountain is covered with a cloud of smoke and fire. And Moses goes up to the top of the mountain to meet with God. And he receives the Ten Commandments, and he comes back down. And when he gets back down to the bottom, he's got to put a veil over his face because his face is like glowing because he's just been close to the presence of God, and it's freaking everyone out. Maybe that's the story that comes to your mind. Or maybe you think of 1 Kings chapter 18. A prophet of God named Elijah squares off against 450 prophets of Baal on top of Mount Carmel. Prophets of Baal build an altar and they put a bull on it and they start singing and dancing and calling out to their God. But nothing happens. So Elijah eggs them on a little and says, well, maybe he's sleeping or he's on vacation or he's gone to the little Baal's room. And so they shout louder and they start cutting themselves with sword, trying to get their God's attention. But nothing happened. And they do this all day long. And when the prophets of Baal are exhausted and anemic, and the evening comes, Elijah builds his own altar and he puts a bull on top of it. He digs a trench around it. He hoses it down with water 4 times until everything was dripping wet and even the trench was filled full of water. And Elijah prays to God and a giant ball of fire comes down and burns up everything. It burns the wood, it burns the sacrifice, it burns the stones, it burns the dirt, and it burns all of the water in the trench. You see, mountaintops had a bit of a reputation. And so here in Mark 9, here's what we see happen. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, John, and with him he led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. And there he was transfigured before him. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. The disciples are understandably terrified in this moment. And Peter sticks with what seems to be his lifelong motto of, when you don't know what to say, just say anything, probably the first thing that comes to your mind. And so he suggests, why don't we set up 3 shelters, Jesus, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. Some people will suggest that the appearance of Moses and Elijah is meant here to symbolize and identify that Jesus is superior to the law and the prophets of the Old Covenant. And some people will note that Moses and Elijah were expected to come and before and return before the Messiah arrived. Both of those are true. But I think the real point of this mountaintop experience is to make one thing very clear to Jesus' disciples. A cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud. This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to him. Suddenly, when they looked around, there was no one longer, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. Here on the mountaintop, God gives the disciples a critical message. This is my Son. Listen to him. See, Mark starts out Act 2 the exact same way he started out Act 1. In Mark chapter 1, we read this. At that time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. As Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw the heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven. You are my Son, whom I love. With you, I am well pleased. God gives the disciples a critical message. This is my Son. Listen to him. And the disciples had kind of figured out that first part. After all, Peter had just acknowledged and declared that he believed that Jesus was the Christ. But God feels the need to kind of remind them of that and emphasize the latter part. Listen to him. And you may think, well, that's probably not really necessary, is it? I mean, after all, the disciples had been listening to Jesus for 3 years now. But nonetheless, God descends on the mountain to tell Peter, James, and John, no, seriously, guys, you need to listen to him. Because they don't realize it yet. But in Act 2, Jesus is going to say some things they don't want to hear. And he's going to do some things that they don't think he should do. And the message from the mountaintop is that this, at the front end of all of the stuff that's about to happen is, no matter what comes next, no matter how you're feeling, don't forget, he is my Son. Listen to him. Which brings us back to Peter's confession in Mark 8. See, the reason Jesus instructs his disciples to not tell anyone who he is because, yes, he is the Christ, but he's not who they think he is. See, starting here in chapter 8, and again in chapter 9, and again in chapter 10, Jesus is going to repeatedly tell his followers that he must now go to Jerusalem, suffer, and die. And this makes no sense to his disciples. In fact, the first time Jesus says this, Peter actually rebukes Jesus. And this isn't the words used here. The language is not encouraging, like, oh no, don't worry, we won't let that happen. It's strong and it's forceful. And Peter is saying, oh no, you won't. Not if I have anything to say about it, Jesus. You see, a suffering Savior was completely incompatible with everyone's understanding of who the Christ was going to be. David Garland says this: in the first century, most Jews believed that the Messiah would be a royal figure, the offspring of David, whom God would empower to deliver Israel from her foes. This king-like figure would be as triumphant as David and as wise as Solomon. Well-known scholar Timothy Keller writes this: for Peter, a suffering Messiah is impossible. The Messiah will come a triumphal hero, dishing out punishment to those who oppose him. The notion that the Messiah would suffer made no sense at all, because the Messiah was supposed to defeat evil and injustice and make everything right in the world. But perhaps what makes this so difficult for us to understand is that not only is Jesus the Christ going to go to the cross, but he called each of his followers to do the same thing. Immediately after telling his disciples that he was going to suffer and die, Jesus follows that up with this: if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Clearly, this message takes a while to sink in for the disciples, as it probably does for us as well. Because in chapter 9, just a little while later, Jesus and the disciples are walking down the road, and the disciples are arguing with one another, and eventually they came to Capernaum, and when Jesus was in the house, he asked them, hey, what were you guys arguing about on the road? They kept quiet, because on the way, they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and servant of all. Later in chapter 10, James and John tried to lobby for top spots in Jesus' question. This naturally cheeses off the other 10 disciples, mostly because they didn't think of it first. And so Jesus says, you guys still don't get it. He says, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Mark chapter 8 is the tipping point of this story. It's where we discover that Jesus does not just want a convoy of people who will marvel at his miracle. He doesn't just want a congregation of people who will enjoy his sermons. He wants a community of disciples who are willing to follow his example and instructions. Jesus says, I am the Christ, but I'm not exactly who you think I am. And I do want you to follow me, but it's not going to exactly be the life you think it is. If anyone wants to be my follower, you must turn from your selfish ways, take up your cross, and follow me. If you hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake and for the sake of the good news, you will save it. The Greek word here for life is where we get our word psyche from. Jesus is saying is that I want the very essence of who you are to be inseparable from me. I want your words to echo my words. I want your actions to imitate my actions. I want your heart to beat in time with my heart. I want you to take up your cross and follow me. And taking up your cross is not just a call to be a martyr in death, although for most of the disciples that's what it would eventually come to. It's also a call to be a martyr in life, to surrender ourselves to doing things God's way instead of our own way, to try not to hang on to control of my own life, but to give up control of my life to Jesus. However, that's not always so easy for us to do. Sometimes those ways don't always make a lot of sense to us. And we're tempted to say, when Jesus says things like, the first shall be last, or the greatest must be a servant, or the humble will be lifted up, or serve others rather than being served, or love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. These things seem kind of upside down and backwards from our perspective. And we say to Jesus, maybe there's another way. Maybe there's a better way, or an easier way, or a more logical way, or a less costly way for me to do this. And we ask Jesus, is this really the way it has to be? Is this really what you want me to do? Is this really the life you want me to live? And God's gentle reply is, this is my son. Listen to him. And that's really our challenge every day and for this upcoming week, to follow Jesus, to imitate Jesus, to live the life that he calls us to, and to take up our cross, follow him, and above all, listen to him. Now, to do that, we have to really know and understand who Jesus is. So we'll continue on that journey next Sunday. And just to let you know, next Sunday, Stan Helton from ABC will be here, and he'll be sharing us from Mark chapter 11. So hope you'll be here for that. We'll hand things back to Jen.